hearing is subdivision 2008-24, Gregory A. and Charlotte L. Hastings.
This is an application to consider the subdivision of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district in Nanticoke Hundred, Sussex County, dividing 14.37 acres into 10 lots using the cluster subdivision concept, located south of Route 404, 2,700 feet west of Road 528. For the benefit of the commission, they have received an exhibit booklet, and it is a part of the record. But also for the benefit of the commission, I'm passing down copies of an opposition booklet. We'll advise the commission that the technical advisory committee members were to respond to this application by February 19th of 2009, that the Division of Soil and Water Conservation Drainage Program, the State Farm Marshal's Office, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the State Health and Social Services, and the Department of Agriculture did respond by February 19th. The Engineering Department comments were received on February 25th. DLDOT comments were received or were dated February 19th of 2009, but we did not receive a copy until March 24th of 2009. I'd also advise the commission that based on comments received from the State DENREC Division of Water Resources dated April 13th of 2009, and based on the information collected to date, it is the opinion of the groundwater discharge section that the proposed subdivision as shown on the plans would be feasible for individual on-site wastewater treatment and disposal systems in accordance with the regulations governing design, installation, and operation of on-site wastewater treatment and disposal systems, dated January 4, 1985, and last amended on April 11 of 2005. And for the benefit of those parties in attendance, the applicant did submit their exhibit booklet on April 6th of 2009, and it provides for a revised preliminary site plan and the exhibit booklet, which contains a project summary, a site data table, consideration of Chapter 99 subdivision ordinance criteria, proposed findings of fact, a copy of the deed to the property, a declaration of covenants and restrictions, technical advisory committee comments, a copy of the application, site photographs, aerial photo overlays, a FEMA flood insurance rate map, a soil map and description, a soil feasibility study, a DLDOT entrance approval letter, and five maps and renderings. And they are a part of the record. The opposition booklet I just passed down was from Lewis W. Briggs II. Was received on April 9 of 2009 and includes a summary of his comments on this application, highlighted concerns on agency comments submitted, and comments that agencies made and that he addressed during the public hearing process for subdivision number 2006-72, the original subdivision application for this site. And gentlemen, that's all I have unless you have questions.
All right, sir, we thank you. First, let me ask, is there anyone here that has an interest in this application this evening? Any of you folks back there? I want to invite you, by all means, to please move up so that you can see the screens. Feel free to get up, move around, take a look at the exhibits. All I ask is that you do it quietly. We do have a public address system here, but we are not going to shout. If you can't hear us, you need to move up so we can see what's going on. You're more than welcome. This is not church, and the lightning bolt's not going to come down and strike you. So that being said, the chair recognizes Mr. Weidman.
Thank you, Mr. Wheatley. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the commission. For the record, I'm Dave Weidman of Hudson Jones, Jaywork & Fisher, and I'm here for the applicants, Greg and Charlotte Hastings. This is an application for the subdivision of 14 acres into 10 lots. And I have Mr. Hastings here with me tonight. And I have Mr. Christenberry here tonight, who is with Axiom Engineering, who prepared the current site plan. I would submit to the commission that we're back here tonight with a superior plan and design prepared by a superior engineer, Ken Christenberry of Axiom Engineering. Later, Mr. Christenberry will highlight the differences between the original plan that was prepared by Century Engineering and Mr. Christenberry's plan, which will indicate to you why the current plan is superior. If you'll turn to tab 2 in the booklet in front of you, tab 2 is a summary of the site data, and I will highlight for you some of the important features of this cluster development. The first important feature we submit is that 40% of this site will remain common area, and I'll note for you that that is less than 40% of the allowed density. So we're talking about a low-density project of 0.7 dwelling units per acre. The remaining site data describes how the project will be laid out and developed. The lot area will comprise 6.35 acres of the site, for example. You can see the lot sizes, the required setbacks, and it notes that this site is existing zoning of AR1 and that it will remain AR1 if you approve the subdivision. The next point that I want to make, if you turn to tab 3, will be a review of the subdivision criteria, and I'm going to go through each element briefly for you to make the record. The first element that you need to look at under 99.9 of the Sussex County Subdivision Ordinance is the integration of the proposed subdivision into the existing terrain and surrounding landscape. And you can see from the aerial map later on in the booklet that this subdivision is located between two parcels that are partially cleared and partially wooded. The parcel to the west adjoins the Ellendale-Redden State Forest. A planned 30-foot buffer is proposed between all the subdivision lots and the surrounding properties. I will turn next to the second element, which is minimal use of wetlands and floodplains. The wetlands on this site are located entirely in the tax ditch, and the only anticipated impact is the placement of riprap that would stabilize any outfalls from the stormwater management ponds. As Mr. Christenberry indicates, a nationwide permit will be required from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to complete that work. If you address the other part of that element, which is the floodplain, any use of the floodplain, part of this site does lie within a Zone A floodplain. And as Mr. Christenberry indicates, there is insufficient data to indicate for that part of the property a base flood elevation. So what we're going to have to do here to establish a base flood elevation is obtain a letter of map revision from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And upon the establishment of the base flood elevation, we will be in a better position to determine whether or not we would possibly lose one lot. But as of right now, we believe that, and Mr. Christenberry can comment on this further, but we believe that we will be able to obtain the required nationwide permit from the Corps, and there will be minimum impact on any floodplains in this case. If you turn to element number 3, preservation of natural and historic features, as I indicated previously, 35% of the wooded part of the property is going to be preserved. The subdivision that Mr. Christenberry has produced is designed with consideration of the impacts on the native woodlands with the goal of conserving as much of the woodlands as possible. And we didn't find any historic features on this property. Under element 4, preservation of open space and scenic views, the view from all the lots will be the buffer, native woodlands, other lots, and that's it. Three areas have been set aside for stormwater management. There's a new area that has been created that will include park benches, picnic tables, and an additional amenity that has been added is a walking trail, I believe, on the traverses the northwest side of the property. Yeah, it's the northwest side of the property. Under element 5, minimization of tree, vegetation, and soil removal and grade changes, the only comment I can make here is that the final road design will incorporate a minimum movement of soil and maintain the current grade to the greatest extent practicable. Under element 6, screening of objectionable features from neighboring properties and roadway, there are no objectionable features visible on neighboring properties. Even so, as I mentioned previously, there will be a 30-foot buffer between all the residential lots and surrounding properties. Under element 7, provision for water supply, all of the lots will be served by on-site wells. Under element 8, provision for sewage disposal, as Mr. Lank indicated, Denrec has issued a feasibility letter, which you have in the file, that indicates that the soils are feasible for on-site septic systems. Under element 9, prevention of pollution of surface and groundwater, this project design includes best management practices. Mr. Christenberry has a certain expertise in stormwater management, and he can comment on that more fully if you have any questions of him about those issues. Under element 10, minimization of erosion and sedimentation and minimization of changes in groundwater levels, increased rates of runoff, potential for flooding. The subdivision is going to, again, use the standard of engineered best management practices. We don't believe it's going to have any significant impact on groundwater levels, and in fact will maximize groundwater recharge. Runoff is going to be directed to the roadside swales and the stormwater management basins. Under element 11, provision of safe vehicular and pedestrian movement within the site and to adjacent ways, the interior road is going to be built to county standards. The cul-de-sac will provide ample turning area for emergency vehicles, and notably, an additional turnaround can be installed adjacent to lot 10 if the commission requires that. We believe that aesthetically it would look out of place, but if you find that that is something that needs to be added to the site, we can certainly do that. As I stated previously, a mulch walking trail will be installed to interconnect the project to the open space amenities. Under item 12, or element 12, effect on area property values, this subdivision is expected to increase property values in the area while providing affordable housing for middle-income families. Under item, or element 13, preservation and conservation of farmland, we believe that the subdivision will increase the supply of affordable lots in Sussex County and therefore decrease the pressure to sell other farmland in the vicinity. Under element 14, the effect on schools, public buildings, and community facilities, we're talking essentially about the addition of 8 residences to this site because there are 2 existing residences already on site. It's expected that any purchasers will be families already living in Sussex County so that the effect on schools and any public facilities will be very minimal. Under element 15, effect on area roadways and public transportation, I will note that an entrance plan has previously been approved. We may have to renew the application, which we do not believe is going to be an issue. There was no traffic impact study required. The site is not in an area that has been identified with seasonal traffic congestion or any other transportation issues, according to DLDOT. Under element 16, compatibility with other area land uses, the proposed subdivision is located in a rural residential agricultural area along the main east-west highway in central Sussex County. Notably, you can see from the aerial photo, the area already consists of single-family homes and farmland, so that the subdivision with the addition of 8 additional residences would be compatible with the other land uses. And I will note now that the proposal is in an area with existing development and 2 major proposed developments within approximately 2 miles, according to one of the maps in the most recent Sussex County Comprehensive Plan. Mr. Christenberry's highlighted those for you on the screen. If we could just show where the proposed
site is,
subdivision is located.
Project is located here. Ken Christenberry, Axiom Engineering, Georgetown. The site is located right here. 2 major developments are located there and there. This is from the most recent update of the county's comprehensive plan, indicating protected lands, developed lands, and major subdivisions that are major developments that are already underway in some way, shape, or form. And, of course, the property itself consists entirely of either developed lands where the existing homes are or unprotected lands for the balance of the property.
So in essence, this is a very small subdivision along a major road that already has single-family homes established and two major proposed developments within just a couple of miles. The last element is effects on area waterways, and as you can see, before the proposed subdivision design was commenced, Mr. Christenberry met with Brooks K. Hall from the drainage section of DENREC regarding the tax ditch, and those issues were discussed. Mr. Christenberry has requested a reduction in width from 92 feet to 37 feet in the easement. That matches the width in the wooded portions of the property that already exists, and as Mr. Christenberry will explain, we do not anticipate any issues with the request to reduce that easement. If there are any issues, it still does not affect the feasibility of the subdivision as proposed. So those are the elements that you'll have to take a look at under section 99.9. If you turn to tab 4, we have several proposed findings of fact for your consideration. I'm not going to read them to you. They're listed in numbers 1 through 12. We would respectfully request that you take a look at them, determine whether you believe that they would enhance the subdivision as proposed. Now, I want to turn to the packet that was submitted earlier today, I believe, and in particular a letter that you received from one of the opponents, Lewis Briggs. Mr. Briggs appeared at the last hearing, and he has submitted his positions in a letter that was presented to you. And I want to address some of the issues with Mr. Christenberry in rebuttal so that we can alleviate any concerns raised by Mr. Briggs or the commission in light of those comments. One of the first points that Mr. Briggs makes is that he believes that only the engineering firm has changed, but little else about the plan has changed. And we would disagree with that. There have been numerous changes between the previous plan, and I think we all can agree that the previous plan, prepared by a different engineer, had some issues with it. Mr. Christenberry has not only addressed those issues, but he's taken a really close look at the proposal and tried to design it in a manner that is most compatible with this site, and that's why we present this to you as a clustered subdivision rather than a regular subdivision. And Mr. Christenberry is going to give you a comparison and contrast between those two plans later. Another issue that Mr. Briggs raised under number one was that he believes that because we're using the boundary survey from Century Engineering, again, nothing about the plan has changed. That's not the case. He does not appear to understand what the disclaimer on the plan submitted by Axiom Engineering actually means. And if you have any questions about that, again, Mr. Christenberry can address that. Under number two of his letter, Mr. Briggs discusses the fact that several of the proposed lots are in the floodplain. Now, this is an issue that we take very seriously in the sense that we don't want to construct any homes that are going to be adversely affected by flooding. Mr. Christenberry can describe for you in detail how FEMA's map is prepared so that you can understand what we're going to do to address that. And actually, if you could comment on that now, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The current status of the property is that it is in a Zone A. There are two kinds of floodplains that exist on properties next to riverine flooding sources. One is Zone A, and the other is Zone AE. The distinction between the two is in the level of detail that's used to prepare the map. Zone A's are very approximate, and as a result, the legal definition of them is that no base flood elevations are determined for a Zone A. The reason for that is they are typically generated from topographic information only. It's rather dated. No computer models are run to determine a likely water surface elevation, things of that nature. A Zone AE, which does include base flood elevations, which we do not have here, does gather enough data to sufficiently predict the level that the 100-year water surface elevation would rise to. the answer that we're going to pursue for this project, because it is a rather significant portion of the property that's subject to the Zone A floodplain. If you look right here on the project, you know, the back half or even more than half of the project is part of the Zone A, so it's a very valid question as to what's going on and how are we going to resolve this. Having worked for the contractor that prepared these maps in the early 90s, I can tell you that I've seen how Zone A's are drawn. And to say it's a very approximate approach is quite frankly, it's an understatement. If you take a look at the topography on the property, from Route 404 all the way to this location here, there's very little relief on the property. It's very flat. You have maybe 1 or 2 feet of relief on the property. As you come back to the area adjacent to the tax ditch, from the rearmost house in the project is right here, and the contour that it's adjacent to is a 34 elevation. The contour that's outside of the tax ditch that's lowest is a 28. So not only would the tax ditch have to be full, it would have to be 6 foot high above the top of the tax ditch in order to flood out the location of these homes. Now, I understand that you're not in a position to take my word for it, and we will have to go to FEMA to have the map legally revised, and that is the process that a letter of map revision does engender. But I can say with a lot of confidence, having done this for 15 years, that it's my professional opinion that it's extremely unlikely that it's anywhere near that 6 foot above the top of the tax ditch. If any of you gentlemen have seen a tax ditch where the top of the ditch is 6 feet below water during a flood event, it'd be something I've never seen, not from a photograph and not in person. So that's the approach, is that we will take the legal steps necessary to modify the map, but on a practical level, we don't believe that any of the homes shown on this plan are going to be subject to flooding.
If you move on in Mr. Briggs' letter, he raises the issue of the tax ditch easement. Again, we have, or we're going to request, a reduction at the front of the property, and Mr. Christenberry is highlighting it for you right now.
What you have now is, from the woods back, it's a 37-foot wide easement. When you get out into the open area, it's 92 feet wide. The reason for that typically is the open areas are normally in active agricultural production, which produce more sediment getting into the tax ditch. So when they do maintenance work, there's more sediment to pull out of the ditch. They want a wider area to spread it out in. What we've done on projects similar to this is one we just got final approval for very recently. It's the Johnsonville subdivision. You may or may not remember it, but this is a very similar case where we have a tax ditch at the back of an agricultural property. The wooded portions of the property had, I believe, an 80-foot wide easement. The non-wooded portions had a 250-foot wide easement. And we were able to successfully have that easement reduced to 50 feet. Now, this is subject to the review and approval of the Denrec drainage section, and they work with the tax ditch managers that are in charge of that particular ditch. And obviously, our final approval should be contingent upon receipts of approval from the Denrec drainage section. In the event that they were unable to grant that easement width reduction, we may see a removal of one of the lots from the project, but we don't see any reason to believe that the project itself would become infeasible.
The fourth point raised by Mr. Briggs' letter had to do with density, and he says the density listed is 0.7 acres to the county requirements, and I'm quoting, of 0.75 in agriculture areas. I'm not sure what he's talking about, but again, we are less than 40% of the allowed density in an AR zone. We're only at 0.7. Mr. Briggs, in his fifth point, discusses the length of Robbins Drive, raises the issue as whether or not it should be defined, therefore, as a major subdivision. This property has, or this subdivision has always been a major subdivision. He asks, Mr. Briggs asks, why the need for extending the cul-de-sac an additional 500 yards, and Mr. Christenberry is going to explain that.
The reason that we did extend the road, I think this would probably be a good time to go through the progression of the plans Direct your attention over here for a moment. This was the plan that was presented at the public hearing last summer. Three-quarter acre lots were shown. There were not sufficient wooded buffers to meet your code on this project. The road ran all the way to the rear of the project. Any road that's over 1,000 feet with a dead-end cul-de-sac does require a waiver from your board. It's not a variance that requires a board of adjustment. It does require your blessing. And so we noted that that was something that we thought we'd like to avoid. So when we re-engineered the project, we did go with a half-acre cluster. We shortened the road in order to eliminate the need for a waiver from the Planning Commission. The shortened road plan looked exactly like this. The difficulty came when we started to do field work for the soils investigation. Knowing that, as Mr. Briggs pointed out, and Dave will probably be mentioning in 30 seconds, the USDA has said from aerial photographs that this site has very limited soils, which makes it incumbent upon the applicant to do a very detailed soil analysis on site, on the ground, with a Class D licensed soil scientist. Every one of these triangles is a soil boring that was done. Every one of the rectangles is a test pit that was dug out with a backhoe. We've done sufficient soil work not only to get the feasibility study approved, which read into the record a few minutes ago, but actually to plan out what type of septic system will go in every one of these 10 lots. So we've gone well above and beyond what's required at a preliminary submittal. In the midst of doing that study, we did find that there were some severe limitations in the soil, and it was necessary to lengthen the road for one reason and one reason only. The best soils on the whole project were actually at the very rear of the property. So in order to allow a minimal use of more challenging septic systems, we actually redesigned the road to use the best possible soils that the project did include. And if you'll notice on the plat, it does indicate what type of septic system is anticipated for each lot in the entire project. And this is the plan that Mr. Klein at DENREC approved with his feasibility letter.
And while we have those maps up, can you just comment momentarily on the additional cul-de-sac that the commission could consider unless they waive that requirement?
Yes. My understanding is that the reason why a 1,000-foot plus cul-de-sac might need an additional cul-de-sac is to allow emergency apparatus the ability to turn around without riding all the way to the end of that cul-de-sac. We do have sufficient room right here. Here's an interesting anomaly on the project. There's two existing homes on the property that bring up a couple issues. And we do have wooded buffers between them and the adjacent properties. However, the existing septic systems for these homes, one of them is located very close to the property line. So this area right in here, this entire triangle, is actually common space where we would intend to provide an easement back to this home to continue to enjoy that septic system rather than rip it out and replace it. Because this is common area, no wooded buffers there, but in order to provide some kind of visual barrier, a privacy fence is proposed in that area where the wooded buffer is not required. It's my understanding that the wooded buffer is required between every lot and all adjacent properties. This is really the only location, that and the ponds are the only location where that wooded buffer may be discontinued. This area in here is sufficient that we could add a turnaround sufficient for emergency apparatus. We just think it would be rather awkward, if you will. And so if you are willing to extend the waiver that we're requesting, that would be great. We would leave the plan as you see it. If you felt as though having that turnaround were important, deny that waiver. We can still provide it right here without affecting the lot layout in any way. The only other thing that would require any consideration of a variance of any kind are the existing structures that are here. Lot 10 has a home with a very small deck that protrudes slightly into the front setback. I'm not sure Mr. Lank may be able to tell me whether or not a variance would be required for that. And if the variance were denied, that deck could simply be removed and reconstructed to pull it out of the front setback. Lot 4 is a little more challenging in that the existing home, because we have a 37-foot easement, a 30-foot wooded buffer, and a 20-foot rear yard setback, there's about a 2-foot encroachment of that existing home into the rear yard setback of lot 4. We would apply for a variance on that simply on the grounds that there's no adjacent neighbor that's going to be impacted by this at all. And we'd like to leave the home where it is. If that's something that you can approve without sending us to the Board of Adjustment, that would be great. My understanding also a shed that has the same condition, and that shed could easily be relocated as well if a variance were not granted.
And I just wanted to note that if the preliminary site plan is approved as is with those setbacks and we don't obtain a variance, it will not, again, affect the feasibility of a subdivision because we will just move the home the 2 feet to make sure that it's compliant and conforming.
Before you go any further, can I try to answer the reference to the waiver of the cul-de-sac? When you submitted your request to resubmit, it was a shorter length street. You came in with the revised site plans earlier in April, which included more of the curvature of the street and because of the septic locations. To get a waiver in the length of the cul-de-sac, you have to be advertised and held during public hearing.
So we can put a turnaround in.
You need to state to the commission that you're going to add the cul-de-sac in your street design, or you're going to have to reapply to subdivide it.
Then we would
get the variance in the length of the cul-de-sac.
We would go ahead and add it then. If that were a condition of the approval, that would not be a problem.
Next, in Mr. Briggs' letter, he notes the requirement of the forested buffer strip, and all I will say about that is that the plan that we've proposed is compliant with this code requirement. In point number 6 in his letter, he references traffic issues. As I mentioned previously, or Mr. Lank mentioned, DelDOT has issued an entrance approval letter as well as an extension of that approval letter. And I think it's fair to say that the addition of 8 residences on this site, if you approve it, is not going to significantly affect congestion in central Sussex County. His point number 7 addresses the homeowners association fee. The covenants as presented to you allow for larger assessments. Mr. Hastings will control the development and the association per its terms for some time, and suffice it to say that the cost of maintaining the common areas is going to fall on him until the association can stand on its own, and then the association can take over and is then obligated under the restrictive covenants to maintain the common areas, and they will have to assess themselves whatever it takes to do that. We've already discussed the DENREC feasibility letter because point 8 in his letter says that he has major concerns about the septic systems. Again, the feasibility letter from DENREC speaks for itself. And then at the very end of his letter, he raises several issues that we have commented on. The need for a variance is the first one. Mr. Christenberry has addressed that issue. Mr. Briggs asks, does the need meet the neighborhood design? This is an AR1 district, and one of the purposes in section 115-19 is for an AR district is to provide for low-density, single-family residential development. And again, this is about as low-density as you can get with a superior design using your cluster ordinance. I believe that I've responded to the issues raised in Mr. Briggs' letter. If not, and you want to follow up, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. I want to note that we have, I think, made extraordinary efforts in light of the last presentation to ensure that we comply with all of the county code requirements. I also want to note that in light of the concerns that have been raised, there was a recent, and your council can review this with you, there was a recent Supreme Court decision by the state of Delaware Supreme Court issued out of Kent County recently, and the Supreme Court basically said that the statutes that you rely upon do not give the commission unfettered discretion to deny an otherwise legally conforming subdivision based upon impact-related concerns expressed by commenting state agencies, which was a pretty significant statement for the Supreme Court to make. In essence, it was suggesting that, you know, if there are impact-related concerns by state agencies upon any particular subdivision application, If it otherwise meets the county code requirements, which this one does, then in essence, it should be approved. So I wanted to highlight that case for you because I think it basically changed some of the way that these subdivision applications have been presented and decided upon by the local planning and zoning commissions. I want to just summarize now by saying that this subdivision is proposed in an AR, or as an AR1 clustered residential development. It's located off of Route 404 in central Sussex County. The 14.37 acre site is located within a low density area, according to your most recent comprehensive plan. A team of design, engineering, soils, and environmental professionals, among others, worked diligently to inventory and analyze the site and the surroundings in an effort to create a residential development that incorporates the existing environmental features in light of preservation goals, aesthetic design, recreational features, and stormwater management. The overall site will provide a diverse amount of natural features and amenities while providing residents with a sense of community. By using the cluster development option in this case, the current Hastings Heritage Plan is superior to the plan presented to you previously. The cluster development allows the subdivision to incorporate smaller, more compact lots while maintaining a larger amount of open space. The open space provides areas of natural habitat within the subdivision as well as areas for passive and active recreation, ultimately increasing the overall quality of life for the residents. The subdivision will be constructed with 8 additional single-family detached homes. Will include a walking, jogging, and biking trail, which will allow the residents to enjoy the natural areas. Throughout the plan revision process, in this case, the design team was able to design the subdivision around the existing wooded area with minimal impacts. And as I said, 35% of the native woodlands will be preserved. Summary, it's been planned in a manner that will minimize the environmental impacts while providing a residential development which preserves the maximum open space. And I will conclude my comments that way and ask Mr. Hastings to come up before I turn the presentation over to Mr. Christenberry for a more technical explanation of the subdivision site plan. And just if Mr. Hastings could come up and if I could ask him two questions. Basically, have I accurately represented your position on the subdivision application to the commission?
Yes, you have.
Excuse me, Mr. Weidman. Mr. Hastings is going to testify as to give us his name and address.
Okay.
My name is Greg Hastings, and I live 434 Delaware Avenue, Millsboro, Delaware.
Thank you, sir. Okay, very well.
So the first question is on the record. The second question is, do you adopt my comments as if you presented them to the commission yourself?
Yes.
Thanks. That's all I have. And I will turn it over to Mr. Christenberry to finish up.
Okay. I'll try to be brief because during Dave's presentation, I was able to work in most of the information that I that hoped to cover today. And I know that everyone's time here is very important. I've already touched on the soils. The complete soil feasibility study is included in the packets that you all have. You've seen the comparison between the prior application and what we've applied for. I think really all I'd like to end with is the cluster design criteria that are outlined in Chapter 115, the AR1. All development shall be in accordance with the latest amendment to the community design standards. This plan is in conformance with the AR1 zoning code for cluster developments that do not have central sewer. Housing types, so be single-family detached dwellings and manufactured homes were permitted by ordinance. The two existing structures on the property are mobile homes. The two lots that encapsulate those homes exceed 3/4 acre. The balance of the project have lots that are between 1/2 acre and 3/4 acre. So the intent is that the two mobiles that are there may be able to remain if the buyers of those lots would like them, but that the balance of the project would be either modular or stick built homes. Forested buffer area with a minimum width of 30 feet shall be provided for lots abutting an agricultural area. There may be some areas that could be argued aren't agricultural, but the 30-foot buffer has been provided around the entire project between all the lots and the adjoining properties. Again, the reference to a 30-foot wide buffer is made multiple times. The majority of that buffer will be existing forest to remain, and in the areas out in the front of the project, there will be a planted buffer that will comply with this requirement. solid fence. The only place that's going to be used is where the existing septic system is located, right there, in order to provide a privacy screen. No lot shall have direct access to any state-maintained roads. A new subdivision road built to county standard, ordinance 99 standards, shall be constructed, and that's where all the lots will pull their access from. All lots shall be configured to be contained completely outside of all wetlands. As we noted before, the only wetlands located on the property are within the tax ditch area itself. There are no lot lines extending to the center line of that tax ditch. As a matter of fact, there's a minimum of a 30-foot buffer beyond the easements of the tax ditch. So that's not an issue at all. And then, of course, the comment number 7 has to do with projects that are on central sewer, and this project is not. Review procedures, sketch plans required. As you can see, I think we've gone beyond the level of a sketch plan in presenting what is present on this property at this time and how it will be affected by the proposal. Information submitted shall include a plan for management of all open space. If you refer to tab 6 is the covenants and restrictions. Article 2, section 2 does discuss open space management. Sussex County Planning and Zoning Commission shall determine that the following requirements have been met. The cluster provides for a total environment design which are superior. And again, to make it a picture worth a thousand words, our argument is fairly simple in that. And for myself, I would much rather live in the plan you see on the right than the one you see on the left. I think I need to say a whole lot more than that. We did provide some amenities that were not included, like the walking trail and a picnic area, as well as just the overall layout of the design, the extensive open space and buffers that were not present in the standard lot option. Mr. Wyman already went through 999C, and this is not within a town center, so that's not an issue as well. That, I have nothing further. If you have any questions, myself or Mr. Wideman or Mr. Hastings, we'll be pleased to entertain them.
All right, sir. We thank you. We'll see if anyone has any questions.
May I ask a question real quick? You will provide us a copy of your PowerPoint display since you've used PowerPoint, which is not part of your booklet.
I'd be happy to. There's only the majority of the PowerPoint display is the booklet.
This section.
There are a handful of slides at the end that are the comprehensive plan map references, and
it's
then
basically this.
I'm sorry,
but I need to copy the whole PowerPoint display.
That's not a problem.
All right, sir. Mr. Hastings. Mr. Hastings. Long time ago. Mr. Gordy.
Okay. You say you do have septic feasibility. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Lank read it into the record. The letter came from Mr. Klein earlier this week.
And you're talking about your buffer surrounding the area, is that existing or will you have to fill in?
The buffer exists currently on about 70% of the project.
Okay.
As you look on this sheet here, P1, from this squiggly line right here is actually the existing woods line. So everything from lot, half of lot 4, all of lot 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are covered by existing forest. First three lots and the first half of lot 4 and a small chunk of lot 10 will have to be a planted buffer.
Okay.
Mr. Gordy, that would be in this area up front on the eastern boundary and this area on the western boundary.
They could do it this way. Well, hold on a second. This line right here, if you follow this, this is where the existing woods are. So forest buffer will be planted here. Fence would be run there along that existing septic system. This forested buffer here is not required by your code because there are not lots located here. It's a road, but we would put it there anyway because we think it would benefit the value of the project. And then from the existing woods here all the way out to the end of lot 1 would be woods. Now, where the stormwater management areas are, if I do find that I have the ability to manage the stormwater of the project in facilities that are smaller than what's shown here, we may plant some more, but that's something that we don't know until we complete our final engineering.
And if this is approved, you would show the landscape plan on vital site plan?
That would be required by both the Department of Ag and by Mr. Lank's office.
Okay. And in the stormwater management, you said you don't know for sure if you could landscape that or not?
It depends on how large. Whenever we draw a concept at this point, the pond size is dictated by more factors than we're able to bring to the table at a preliminary submittal. Based on my experience, I would say that the three stormwater areas shown, the one in the rear and the two out front, should be more than adequate. But I have had projects where I've ended up needing more space for the stormwater management than I initially projected. And a worst-case scenario for my client would be that where he thought he was going to have a residential lot, he instead has a pond.
Because there's always concern about a stormwater management pond along the major highway.
DLDOT requires and has for about the last 2 to 3 years a 20-foot setback of any pond from a front property line. What we have here, though, is they've already asked for a 15-foot wide easement for a future bike path. And so from that easement, there's only a 5-foot gap. So between the ditch that's here, the 10 feet that DLDOT wants to steal from us, the 15 feet that we have to section off as a future bike path easement, we're quite far from the actual pavement out there with where our pond is. I do agree that that's an issue, but that's how DLDOT has chosen to resolve it. And as I noted, this entrance that I show here is identical to the Century entrance plan, which was approved. That approval letter that I showed you was addressed to Century, but the plan that was approved from Century Engineering does not need to change to accommodate this project.
And has there been any discussion with the Fire Marshal's office about the proposed cul-de-sac?
That would be something that would happen during our final review. We would take
no discussions at all.
No. And again, if they review the plan, well, it sounds like it's already been decided because of the procedural means that we're going to have to add a turnaround, and that would be in this location right here.
Okay. In the amount of open space on the last application compared to what open space you have now?
Let me check their plan. I'm not quite sure because I didn't engineer their plan. They are total area of open space is 3.7624 acres, and our application now has, we have 6.14 acres of common area. Now, that does include tax ditch easement, which also has a walking trail in it. That includes the forested buffers, which are not included within any of the lots. They're exclusive of the lots, and all the stormwater areas are included in that. There's 6 acres. So the common area is almost equal to the lot area.
That's all the questions I have right now, Mr. Wheatley.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Christensen, just have a few questions for you. Following up with what Mr. Gordy said about the buffer and all, if the project were approved in those spaces where there's existing vegetation, trees, and whatnot, do you think that you'd be compatible with putting the silt fence at the buffer line?
Actually, when we construct the roads, we would... couple things we would do. We would do more than that. If you want me to describe it, I can.
No, you've answered it.
Okay. Yeah, we would certainly do that, and we would, because the intent would be to maintain the existing forest to the greatest extent.
And that's possible. Why, when we asked this question about putting the silt fence at the buffer line so the mature trees stay intact.
It would either be at the buffer line or even further into the lot to just allow enough room to put in a home and the septic system.
Was there any thoughts, I know you went before the Technical Advisory Committee, a development of only 10 lots, there's no requirement to go to plus, but was there any thought of going to plus in this, in your process, just to get their feedback?
Having been to plus with quite a few projects, honestly, I didn't feel as though there was a lot to gain from the additional comments, because most of the comments that are pertinent are gathered through the Technical Advisory Committee process.
Right. The letter of no objection from DLDOT which is, as I think Mr. Briggs pointed out, isn't an endorsement of the project, but saying that they don't object to.
It's not their job to endorse or condemn a project. It's their job to regulate access.
Did you have any scoping meeting with them? Is there any agreement to provide turn lanes, acceleration, deacceleration lanes, any of those safety factors for not only the possible residents of Hastings Heritage, but the other traffic utilizing the highway?
For a project with this few new lots, remember we're talking about 8 new lots, additional lots, the entrance plan that was proposed by Century Engineering indicated what's called a hammerhead entrance. And that is one that does not include decel lanes, does not include bypass lanes, because it's a very small project. I've done projects with quite a few more lots than that didn't always require decel lanes. The trigger for a decel lane is determined by several things. And his cell phone is not one of them. The factors that they look at is how much traffic is on the road. Well, obviously, in this case, there's a lot of traffic on the road. You know, Route 404, especially in the summer, very, very busy road. But the other factor they look at is how much project traffic is generated. And this project does not meet the threshold that would trigger either a decel lane or a bypass lane. I did not meet with DelDOT about a new entrance approval because in January 16th of 08, they approved the entrance that Century Engineering had designed, and I simply contacted them and asked them if I could get an extension on that approval, and that extension of the approval was granted, and that's what this letter is. Mm-hmm. So the entrance plan that was engineered prior has been extended. Now, it still may expire before we get all our other permits, but having worked with DelDOT on similar projects before, having a very similar entrance plan reapproved by them is a very high likelihood because they put Century through the same process that they put any of us through.
So included in that answer, and for the benefit of any interested members of the public here or listening on the internet, no matter what this commission does, there could be still further meetings with DelDOT regarding the entrance and
There could be in the event that this expires before we are able to construct.
All right. Thank you. You mentioned that you have the, Mr. Lank read in that the site evaluations have been approved or preliminarily, and that you...
Not precisely. What's been approved is the feasibility study. Mm-hmm. What we did above and beyond what's normally occurring at this early stages, we actually had site evaluations for each lot prepared. Mm-hmm. Those can't be approved until the lots are recorded. Mm-hmm. But the subdivision feasibility letter was approved, and Mr. Lank's office received that approval prior to this hearing.
Some of what I read indicates that Deep Creek Branch is considered a major tributary going into the Chesapeake Bay. I think you will find that the new DENREC regulations that took effect midnight December 31st, if you're within 1,000 feet of a tributary. Am I correct in this, Mr. Christianberry?
I believe those regs that you're referring to is probably the pollution control strategy.
Yes,
is that what you're
part of that, yes.
The pollution control strategy that was adopted recently affects the Inland Bays watershed only. So if we were on the east side of Georgetown, we would need to take those regulations under advisement. Because it's flowing to the Chesapeake Bay, the pollution control strategy for that watershed has not yet been adopted. Okay. So that's a pending regulation. My opinion of how it's working is that they wanted to do the Inland Bays first because of the development pressure that's there, duke it out with the developers and the environmentalists and have a big brouhaha, and then once they reached an agreement about what could be adopted there, I don't think it'll take them long to adopt it through almost every watershed in the state. Because ultimately, the water that we have around us, if it doesn't sit in a pond in your backyard, it's either going to the bay or the ocean.
Are you finding that these septics are going to be as
indicated by your research, are they going to be some of these advanced treatment type?
We only need that on one lot.
Only on one.
Lot one will probably be a drip irrigation system, and that may require advanced treatment because of the separation from water table. Lots, the other lots will be systems that are engineered in accordance with the non-alternative regulations, mm-hmm. LPPs, mm-hmm. and possibly some sand mounds. Mm-hmm.
And I just have another question, more soliciting your opinion and respecting your credentials as an engineer. You've got a couple tabs in here with a lot of scientific data, description of soil types, things like that. Just in your opinion on a A, B, C, D, how would you rate these soils that you're working with here?
Adequate. Adequate is
so
what I would call
it.
Yeah, they meet the requirements of the regs, as the letter from DENREC indicated.
Not exceptional, but they meet or exceed a minimum.
Exceptional soils, you have gravity systems on every lot, and that's not the case on this project at all. You know, we have about half LPPs, and then it does have some mounds. The actual system that's proposed for each lot is indicated on sheet P2 of your packet, the large fold-out.
And one last question. You did a lot of soil borings and all for the septic. In your 99-9C, you mentioned about individual wells. Did you do any type of test boring, or you get a sense of what the water quality for the residential wells will be?
DENREC doesn't really have a specification on water quality testing. Now, when a well is drilled, often it's advisable to either the builder or the buyer that they actually run a water test. But at this point, that's actually not regulated. Whether that's good, bad, or ugly is not something I really feel at liberty to comment on, but that's mm-hmm. that's the case. I don't know if the neighbors that are here have had good or bad experiences with their own wells. I don't know.
Thank you. That's all.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question first is directed to Mr. Lank.
Sir.
In a cluster subdivision, are mobile homes permitted?
No. It would also be subject to variances to retain, or not special, not variance, but special use exception if they were desirous to retain the mobiles on less than 5 acre parcel. So that's the way they were permitted. And that's a process through Board of Adjustment, but I don't, that hadn't been an issue on clusters. We'd have to research that a little because the only ones we've had have been on larger parcels where they wanted to reduce it to, say, a 3/4 acre lot and retain the mobile in the same location and convey it so that it could be replaced at some future time.
And Mr. Christenberry, what's the minimum size houses that you're proposing for these lots?
Do you have anything in the covenant that addresses that?
For that answer, we would have to turn to tab 6. And if you look at Article 4, Section 6, it says no residence shall be constructed on any lot having livable floor space of less than 1,500 square feet for a one-story dwelling. If the dwelling is two stories or a story and a half, the first floor shall have a minimum of 1,000 square feet, and the remaining second story or the half the story shall be 500 on the second floor. So those would be the minimums.
So a minimum 1,600 for one story?
1,500.
1,500?
Yes.
And what size are the mobile homes that are currently located on this property?
I don't know. I haven't seen them. Do you know, Mr. Hastings?
One's 1,100 square feet. The other's about 1,400
square feet. Okay. I have no further
questions. All right, sir. Mr. Burton.
I just have one for clarification on the flood zone question. You mentioned that it was an A in the A in the flood zone map, and that you would have to you'd have to get better clarification on that And you're proposing to do that?
Yes. It's actually written right into your code. If you go to Chapter 99 of the code, there's a definition of floodplain that states any subdivision over 5 acres is required to have the following. Come on in. Wrong button. Sorry about that. This is a quote from your Chapter 99. In addition, for all subdivision proposals and other proposed developments greater than 50 lots or 5 acres, whichever is the lesser, and we're greater than 5 acres, of course, the developer shall include within such proposals base flood elevation data utilizing hydrologic and hydraulic engineering techniques undertaken only by professional engineers or others of demonstrated qualifications. The hydrologic is where you examine the watershed, run a model, and determine how much water is trying to get through the ditch, and the hydraulics is simply determining, knowing how much water is coming, how high will that back up.
So you would then convert the A to the AL zone or whatever?
Yes. What they issue is the letter of map revision. They would actually take the FEMA map, and they would cut out the piece that's around our property, and they would indicate where the floodplain actually lies based on the information that we give them. And then they would, after they reviewed it and approved it and blessed it, they would issue that letter saying, they would issue the letter to Mr. Lang's office stating a detailed flooded study has been done. This letter of map revision indicates that in this section of this tax ditch, the floodplain boundary should now be here. And a new floodplain boundary would exist. Next time the maps are revised, which happens about once a decade, that information would be reflected in that new map. But it would be legally effective the minute they issue our letter.
Thank you.
No further questions.
All right, sir. We thank you. Mr. Lang?
No questions.
Counts?
Just want to follow up on the point that was just made. If this were approved and I wanted to buy a lot that's within the map floodplain that exists right now, would I have to pay flood insurance or not?
I believe you would until a base flood elevation was established, because it is a legally binding floodplain. I think it's technically far from accurate.
I understand that part, but
yes, there are people.
The insurance
there are plenty of folks,
is based on the map.
Correct. There are plenty of folks in this county who pay flood insurance because of a Zone A floodplain.
So my question is, are you going to take care of that before the lots are recorded, or is that up to the individual purchaser to take care of afterwards?
Yeah, I don't believe you have any choice.
I think we can represent that we need to take care of that before the lots would ever be recorded.
Okay. I believe you're
so that should not be an issue.
The code I just shared with you on the definition of floodplain mandates that we do that.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to get a handle on when it's going to happen so that people understand what the process is here. The other question is, I think somebody represented that there's only a minor wetland area. Who made that determination?
The folks at Century Engineering have a wetland scientist who flagged the ditch and the ditch only in their field. So that was their delineation on the property. We will take, when we design our stormwater management, in probably two locations, right here next to this pond and right here next to this one, we'll have some kind of riprap apron that bumps right up to the edge of the wetlands, and we'll probably have a very minor impact. We will submit that minor impact for a nationwide permit to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And that permit is reviewed. We give them the wetland delineation for the entire property and allow them to make their comments, and then they usually issue that permit. They're supposed to issue within 45 days of receiving a completed application, but
just
believe it or not,
sure
federal government doesn't always do what they're supposed to.
Make sure I understand. Thus far, neither you or anybody associated with your firm is a certified soil scientist that's made a determination.
Correct.
In regard to this site.
I guess we can go back to the first objection from Mr. Briggs. He was concerned that I had used a boundary survey, a topographic survey, and a wetland delineation from the prior firm. There are plenty of things that I don't appreciate about the prior application, but I have no reason to believe that their land surveyor doesn't know how to survey a piece of property, and I have no reason to believe that their wetland scientist
doesn't do wetlands work,
but
because...
But there's a report from that scientist in the record someplace.
I believe that that's
the case.
Just
a map delineation.
I believe that's the case. But when we come in with our final approvals, it will include a nationwide permit that I will probably not use Century's wetland scientist to get the nationwide. I'll probably run with JCN Environmental, who is a very reputable firm that you all, most of you here, are familiar with Jim McCauley's office.
The reason I'm bringing the subject up is we've had other occasions where there's been debatable determinations made, and I think in other cases we've asked for firm delineation from a certified scientist in the record. And I just want to make sure that we've established whether or not there's one in the record.
That, I'm not even sure if there is one, but there will be before we come back to this body for final, because our nationwide permit would include a delineation of the entire property.
Thank you.
Just a point of clarification, Council. Items submitted in the previous application are not in this record.
Not unless formally adopted in some fashion.
Okay. That doesn't mean that you can't submit it later. I'm just saying, just before there's any confusion about carrying over from one to the other, the previous application was withdrawn. This is a new ball game. So you really can't rely on what was submitted before.
Right.
Not that that certainly doesn't prevent you from submitting it later on, which would be a requirement anyway, so it's not an issue. But I just, for the benefit of the folks that are here, that previous application, we can't rely on any of that information. We have to rely on what's being presented to us now. And I just wanted to make that point for the public. Okay. Council, any questions?
Yeah, just to follow up on one thing that Mr. Johnson asked, because I was talking to Lawrence about that, the ordinance itself does not preclude the manufactured homes that are on the property. They will, however, have to go before the Board of Adjustment for special use exceptions to retain those, together with whatever variances might be necessary once the site surveys are completed.
They're on 3/4 acre lots.
They are on 3/4 acre.
That's what I thought. I forgot that one. I answered the question. But as long as they're on 3/4 acre lots, they would still have to go to the board.
Right.
And they could be within the subdivision, but they couldn't be on a cluster lot. So they couldn't add additional double lots, basically.
Right. Right.
But the lots won't be large enough.
And that's written into our covenants and restrictions as well.
We had a similar situation to that on one of the Marathon Farm subdivisions over near Route 13. There was existing 3 mobile homes, I believe, double wides on it, and they built around the subdivision around those 3, and they still retain them. They may have been replaced today, but
at the time they were
double wides.
Yeah, they stayed there. Okay. All right, gentlemen, we thank you. If you'll take a seat nearby, we'll see if there's anyone here with an interest in your application. Is there anyone that would like to speak in favor of subdivision 2008-24, Gregory A. and Charlotte L. Hastings? Is there anyone here that would like to speak in opposition to subdivision 2008-24? Yes, sir. Step right up. Would be so kind as to give us your name and address, and then you may have the floor.
My name's Richard Rockman, and I live right close to this. I was here to the other meeting, too, and really and truthfully, I don't see many changes that these people is presenting to you. I've lived out there 11 years, and I can just go tell you by common sense or experience. When you have to have knee boots to walk across a piece of property, I call that wetlands. And I've hunted most of this property, and I can tell you when it's wet season, it's underwater. But I do have a problem with mostly is that most of us out there that's bought and built 20-some 100 square feet homes out there, that this man is trying to develop a piece of property and stick 1,500 square feet homes on her. What's that going to do to value our property and our neighborhood? I mean, I'm sure that none of you would want that in yours or present that. I would think they try to keep the neighborhood like it is. My other comment is, they talk about Delta, about the traffic. Well, when you stop at your driveway and you're 5 miles from town and traffic's backed up to your driveway, I say you'd have a problem. or you have to let 50 cars go by to get out of your driveway. I think you got a problem. But apparently they don't. Another issue that I think that they didn't present, they talked about trails and picnic tables, but they never talked about keeping up the value of the land that's out there to today. To me, what they're trying to do is all about greed, and he's trying to make a dollar. And I just don't think he's keeping up with the neighborhood out there. That's the way it should be done. And I hope you turn this down.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Who's next? Yes, sir.
My name's Jake Adle. I live right beside the cup property, or one property over. I agree with Richard 100%. Other than this wetland stuff, I've seen that place flood back in the 80s. I've been there for 33 years, and believe me, I know what I'm talking about. I have nothing against this man here or anybody here.
Understand? But, it's not personal.
They talk about, you know, building more homes. They're going to put, what, eight more in there. With the economy like it is, there's houses out there for sale everywhere. Why build more? Go up the street 1 mile from there towards Bridgeville. Look on your right. They're all for sale. And they're getting ready to build more. But, I mean, but to me, you know, I'm just a little guy. I don't know a damn thing. But, you know, it's up to you people. I'm not talking mean down to you. I'm talking to you because you're the ones got to do the thing.
That's right.
So thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Anyone else? Okay, anyone on commission have any questions? There being none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll invite you to remain with us for the rest of your Thursday evening to see if we make a decision, or you may wish to call the office in the morning. Our next public hearing is a conditional use number 1773 Davis Bowen and Friedel Incorporated.
This is an application, this application is to consider the conditional use of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district for a convenience store with gas pumps and a car wash to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Cedar Creek 100, Sussex County, on a parcel containing 4.047 acres, more or less, and lying at the northwest corner of U.S. Route 113 and Route 16. Based on comments received from DelDOT and dated July 24th of 2007, the traffic impact study is not recommended. The corridor capacity preservation program will permit the property owner to develop a rights-in access along Route 113. The site's main access shall be developed along Route 16. Significant improvements will be needed at this intersection to accommodate other planned developments, such as Isaac's Glen and Elizabethtown. And because they will contribute to the increase in traffic there, the department recommends that the developer be required to enter into a signal agreement for this intersection and to dedicate right-of-way along Route 16 frontage as needed to permit the construction of a second westbound lane. That while the department can, being the Department of Transportation, as necessary, address these items through the plan approval process, it would also be appropriate for the county to include them in the conditional use approval. The existing level of service B of U.S. Route 113 could change to a level of service C. The existing level of service B of Route 16 could change to a level of service C also. Additional comments received by fax from DelDOT dated April 15th of 2009. Advise that the developer has made an effort to work with DelDOT to arrive at an acceptable access concept for the proposed development. There has been tentative agreement on the site access concept plan that several things will be required prior to the department issuing a letter of no objection, that these include the need for the developer's engineer to use the concept plan as a basis for a detailed site plan acceptable to DelDOT,
that the developer is aware of the fact that all costs associated with the required entrances and all site improvements will be borne by the developer. The DLDOT will require the developer to agree to remove the rights out egress from the site onto U.S. Route 113 if in DLDOT's assessment operational condition is degraded and the egress becomes a safety concern in the future. We also received comments from the Sussex Conservation District and were advised that the site contains three different soil types, that the developer will be required to follow recommended erosion and sediment control practices during construction and to maintain vegetation, that no storm flood hazard areas or tax ditches are affected, that it may not be likely that off-site drainage improvements will be required, and that it's very likely that on-site drainage improvements will be required. We also received comments from the County Engineering Department Utility Planning Division, and they make reference that this site is located in the Ellendale Sanitary Sewer District, that Ordinance Number 38 construction will be required, that additional system connection charges will be required, that the current system connection charge rate is $6,848 per equivalent dwelling unit, that the parcel is served by a duplex grinder pump located near the westerly end of the parcel's frontage on Route 16, that the duplex grinder pump and a 1.5-inch force main currently serves the parcel may not be adequate for the proposed use and the upgrades could be required, that any needed upgrades will be at the property owner's expense, that additional information is required before a capacity determination and EDU assessment can be made and needed upgrades identified, and that a concept plan will be required. And so I think that's all I have other than passing down the site plan for this application.
All right, sir, we thank you. Once again, if there is anyone here with an interest in this application, please feel free to get up, circulate, take a look at the plans, move up a little closer so that you can hear what's going on. And at the appropriate time, you will absolutely be given the opportunity to speak. And with that, the chair recognizes Mr. Crouch.
Good evening, gentlemen. For the record, Zach Crouch with Davis Bowen and Fidel.